Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
You're welcome on in to Tuesday's edition of Kildare Focus. In just a moment, we'll be speaking to the Chief Executive of the Irish Dental Association about the fact medical card holders are unable to access treatment. We'll be hearing from the Chief Executive of CyberSafe Kids, Alex Cooney, about plans by US Attorney General's urging Facebook to drop its proposals for an Instagram platform for children aged under 13. The Irish Hospital Consultants Association has highlighted the reduction by 30% in the number of acute mental health beds available. I'll be talking about that, but to Professor Patricia Casey. And as you've heard on our news bulletins, protests took place outside several maternity hospitals today, calling for the easing of restrictions allowing partners to attend scans and all stages of labour. We'll be talking to Creasha Lynch, Chair of the Association for Improvements in the Maternity Services of Ireland, about that. As always, you can get in touch, comments, requests or dedications by text or WhatsApp to 0833 97 97 97, studio@kfmradio.com, or you can tweet us at KFM Radio. Now, Fintan Horahan joins me on the line. He's the Chief Executive of the Irish Dental Association. Fintan, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Ciara.
I know that you've spoken on this programme and indeed on many others about the difficulties medical card holders are having in accessing dental treatment. Indeed, your AGM took place in recent days, where the association says it's lost faith in the ability of the Department of Health to listen to the profession and bring about real and substantive change. What challenges are medical card holders facing?
Well, there are very real difficulties. I know it's very apparent in Kildare and in fact across the whole country for medical care patients to access a dentist, and that reflects the fact that large numbers of dentists have left the scheme. And the reasons they have left the scheme, well, that's a matter for each individual dentist, but I think it reflects the fact that they have been long frustrated by the scheme. But I think the ultimate straw to break the camel's back was promises that were made throughout the pandemic crisis to help dentists meet their costs around things like PPE, which were never delivered upon. Constant promises to review the operation of the scheme, and none of that has been followed through on. Dentists have costs to meet in terms of running their practices. The medical card scheme is flawed fundamentally, and many of them have said they can't continue, and they really want to see something better brought in as a matter of urgency.
I know that you've noted, Fintan, that it's a matter for each individual dentist and their respective practices as to whether they engage with the scheme or not. But what are some of the issues that they have brought to you saying, this is why I can no longer continue being involved in this scheme?
Well, you know, the scheme was due to be reviewed and replaced over nearly 15 years ago, and the Department of Health at the time withdrew from those discussions. Dentists have persevered with the scheme all the years since, very much because they felt that those who have the greatest difficulty accessing a dentist need some level of support. But the reality is that the restrictions in terms of the treatments that can be offered to patients, the delays in the bureaucracy associated with getting permission to provide some of those treatments, the fact that the fees the state pays are half of what the dentist would receive from private patients, but I think ultimately the fact that they incurred significant extra costs in running and keeping open their practices during the pandemic. They were given a specific promise by the then minister last June that they would receive PPE, and they're one of the very few settings which received no support from the state. And I think for many of them, they were saying, well, that's the last straw. You know, we have costs to cover. We're not happy with the scheme for patients or for ourselves. And they've said, well, unless the department steps up to the mark and comes together with an entirely new scheme, which is what we have been advocating for many years, we're not prepared to continue with it.
Do you have any sense at all, Fintan, as to why the department has elected not to engage on this? Significantly fewer than a third of the country's 2,500 general practice dental surgeries are engaged with the scheme. You've noted that there were, you know, calls for reform or statements to that effect, that the department was willing and inclined to reform somewhere around 15 years ago. The issues with treatment delays and fees have clearly been live and active for that entire time.
Well, I think it reflects nothing more than a lack of political urgency or political will to address the issue. I mean, it's not as if this is, should have come as any surprise to any of the people in the Department of Health. They simply have not seen it as being of sufficient urgency to warrant their time and their effort. You know, the pandemic is used as an excuse for all sorts of things not to happen. But the reality is that this was something which was neglected for many years before we ever heard of COVID-19. So the I suppose the positive news is that at the weekend, Minister Donnelly addressed our AGM and said he will be directing his officials to engage with us as a matter of urgency and to remove any obstacles to progress. I hope that finally materialises because, as many dentists said, we've heard this before and it hasn't resulted in anybody paying any attention to this issue. So we can only hope that this will finally produce some urgency and that there will be discussions take place sooner rather than later, because, you know, it takes two sides to enter discussions. We've been available all this time. So I hope the Department of Health does actually engage with us for once.
And the net effect of it not doing so over successive years has been, you know, patients have not received perhaps the treatment that they need in the first instance, therefore the treatments that they require when eventually they can access the medical card service are significantly more grave than they might have required at an earlier point. Your members are constrained in the treatments that you can provide and also are effectively out of pocket for seeing every medical card patient.
Yeah, I mean, all of that is true, but what we're seeing now is that patients are literally travelling half the country to find dentists who will see them, and that's becoming increasingly difficult because if one or two dentists are being expected to see every last, you know, medical card patient who contacts them, then that's not sustainable for the dentist. It's not in anybody's interest. What we need is to have a system where, you know, it works for patients and it works for dentists. That's not something we currently have. But, you know, the losers in all of this are obviously the medical card patients, because if they're not seeing their dentist, their oral health is going to decline. It's going to become more difficult to treat and to repair whatever damage that is caused by all of these delays. So, you know, oral health is an integral part of general health, so important to our everyday lives. And I think, you know, ultimately, listeners need to contact their local TDs, to contact the HSE if they can't find a dentist, if they have a medical card patient, and demand that you know, the promises made are actually delivered upon this time.
Fintan Horahan, Chief Executive of the Irish Dental Association, thank you indeed for joining us. I want to bring you a little bit more information on one of the keynote stories in our headlines at 2 o'clock. So 10 people shot dead at Ballymurphy 50 years ago were innocent and their deaths were without justification. A coroner has ruled within the last 30 minutes. They were killed over a period of 3 days in August 1971 during unrest in Belfast when the government moved to detain IRA suspects without trial. Relatives applauded when Mrs. Justice Keegan exonerated them and found that there had been a disproportionate use of force. She said shootings had been a violation of Article 2 of the European Convention on Human Rights, which is the right to life protected by law. Now, US Attorneys General are urging Facebook to drop plans for an Instagram-style platform for children aged under 13. Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble has been speaking to Alice Cooney about this. She's co-founder and chief executive of CyberSafe Kids.
Alex, a bipartisan group of 44 US attorneys general, they've written to Facebook, the chief executive Mark Zuckerberg, asking him to drop the plans that Facebook has for a version of Instagram for kids under the age of 13. Now, technically, kids under the age of 13 are not allowed to use the Instagram app in its current form. That's due to federal privacy regulations over in the States. Just how impactful would children under the age of 13 using platforms like Instagram be on them in their experience of growing up?
I mean, it's a big question. And, you know, I think we also have to be realistic that children under the age of 13 are already using those platforms. So most of them would have a minimum age restriction of 13. And we know there's plenty of evidence to tell us that that doesn't work. You know, we know from our own data and our own surveys that about 23% of children are on Instagram, for example, the Instagram as it is now. This is not the child-friendly version that they're proposing. You know, so it's that we know that age verification doesn't work. We know that it's a challenge to stop children engaging on with social media. So, you know, as to the impacts, you know, there's no conclusive I suppose research that tells us you know that these are the specific impacts, but we, you know, there'd be plenty of concerns around, you know, the impacts on mental health, you know, how ready children are in that young age bracket to be exposed to some of the content that they might come across. You know, there's issues with self-esteem and you know, there's the possibility of being exposed to people that they don't know who may wish them harm. You know, there's lots of risks in the online environment. And I think we need to really get to grips with managing those risks better and preparing our children better. And to trying to ensure that they are only accessing those platforms when they are ready to do so. And that, you know, that is a judgment call that parents will need to make.
Yeah.
The minimum age restrictions are there as a guideline, I suppose. But as I said, they don't work.
And look, it's true, they don't work. And kids can get around things. Anybody can get around rules and regulations, unfortunately, some people may say. And they're obviously already using these apps. So do you believe it's almost more responsible of a platform like Facebook or other social media platforms that may choose to do something similar to explore a parent-controlled experience? Because one thing I noted, obviously, going back to COVID-19, as everything does connect these days, 15 months ago, kids were taken out of school, they were taken away from their friends, obviously, people were a lot more strict back at the beginning of the pandemic, and kids may have felt left out and lonely. And a lot of parents I've heard just within calling the station here saying that they felt like they needed to let their kids on social media platforms that prior to a pandemic they probably wouldn't have.
I think you're right. I think there's been a huge increase in children, you know, being online in general. And I think the point that we would make to parents, because we work with children mainly in primary school, so the kind of 8 to 13 bracket and their parents, you know, and we would say that the key thing really is the readiness of the child, you know, and your willingness as a parent or carer to engage with them in their online journey or on their online journey, you know, to take that responsibility to parent on it. You know, like we parent on so many other things in our children's lives, whether it's teaching them to ride a bike or to cross a road safely or to be safe around water. You know, we just do those things automatically. We don't even think about it. And there's a sort of preparation piece that we would go through with them around those things. And we're not doing that same thing with the online world. You know, we're kind of letting them loose in lots of ways. You know, now obviously there are some parents that are more on it and some parents that will be using parental controls. But really the key thing that we need to be doing is having conversations with them, making sure that, you know, that they're well prepared, that that we've got good rules and in place and we stick to them. So, for example, not using devices in bedrooms behind shut doors, but using them instead in family spaces where we can keep an eye on them. And this, of course, is particularly for kids in that younger age bracket. You know, we're kind of talking about under 13s here. So I think we need to be really careful that if our children are online, that we're keeping an eye on what they're doing, we're having conversations. And, you know, once they're allowed to be on things like social media or maybe online gaming, that, you know, we've prepared them well for those things, you know, so that they will come to us if there's ever an issue, and that we have a sense of what they're doing.
Going back to this specific thing about Instagram in the US, the effort of the Attorneys General, it is backed by this campaign over in the States called Campaign for a Commercial-Free Childhood. You mentioned some of the threats of children being online, talking to strangers, you know, certain images circulating of themselves or of others that they are not at the age to see. When it comes to advertising and the I guess, the adverts that children are consuming, and the effect of seeing those adverts day in, day out can have on them on platforms like this. Is there any research behind that?
Yeah, I mean, there are. There's obviously that campaign in the US, and there's a campaign that's ongoing in the UK that is calling for similar measures to be put in place to protect children from advertising. In fact, the digital age of consent, which was introduced as part of the GDPR back in 2018, was also about trying to put rules in place and ensure that we set the digital age of consent in Ireland at 16, so children under that age need parental consent to access online services like, for example, Instagram or TikTok, and they're not supposed to have their data collected, they're not supposed to be advertised to, you know, so there are some rules already in place, but again, it's about how can we make those actually effective. You know, I've spoken to children who talk about being scared by some ads that they've come across, you know, and, you know, they are absolutely influential, and, you know, we really need to help children understand.
Alex, could you give me an example of an advertisement that some kids said scared them?
So it was to do with horror movies. It was advertising a horror movie, and even the poster that was advertising it was, you know, scary. You know, there were kids, horror movies are a big topic of discussion, and, you know, some kids love them, some kids don't, you know, but there may be a bit of pressure to kind of watch certain ones. But yeah, it was in relation to horror movies.
And at CyberSafe Kids, do you believe that kids should live an ad-free childhood, or should they have some sort of I guess interpretation of what they may be facing in years to come when it does come to advertising? Because as we know, even us adults can be highly influenced and also swayed in our beliefs when it comes to what's being advertised in front of us.
Yeah, I mean, I think what we believe is that there needs to be a whole lot more education around the kind of content we come across, be it targeted advertising or you know, filter bubbles or whatever. So there should be the education, and we also believe there should be a lot more pressure on these companies to design their platforms in an ethical way, to not collect data from children, to not advertise to children, that this should just be standardized across the board. TikTok a few months ago introduced some new measures for their 13 to 16 year old users, and they pledged to not collect their data, to not advertise to them, to ensure that their accounts were set to private by default. You know, so these are measures that we know these companies can easily put in place, and it should be, as I say, standardized across the board for children specifically, and a lot more safety measures for all users. Like, why don't we all have our accounts set to private by default, and then it's up to us to choose whether or not we want to make them public?
Well, Alex Cooney, co-founder and chief executive of CyberSafe Kids, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
And that was Kildare Focus producer Ciara Noble. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking the energy paradox and the sharp decrease in the number of acute mental health beds available right across Ireland.
Kildare Focus with Ciara Plunkett.
Energy has never been cheaper or come at a greater cost. To discuss resolving the paradox of satisfying the needs of all while using far less energy, I'm joined on the line by John Gibbons. He's an environmental journalist and co-author of the Routledge International Handbook of Environmental Journalism, and author indeed of the article in the Irish Times of that title. John, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much, Ciara.
So we're using significantly more energy. We've always, and I'm speaking globally here, been very inclined to consume vast amounts of energy, but not necessarily inclined to diversify how we generate that energy. Well, how are you proposing to resolve this paradox?
Yeah, I guess it's a tricky one. Let's be honest about it. The first thing I would say is that energy is a curious thing. If you examine, for example, the total energy usage globally in the 20th century, that was greater than all the energy used by every human in the preceding 20 centuries. So go back 2,000 years, add up all the energy that all our ancestors used to power their civilizations for 2,000 years. We use more than that in just the 20th century. In fact, we use more than that between 1950 and 1999. So what that tells us, Kira, is that we have drastically changed our relationship with energy. Mm-hmm. And of course, all this energy comes, as you described in your intro, this is cheap energy, largely accruing from digging up fossilized energy. This is basically what some people call ancient sunlight. This is fossil fuels, whether it's coal or oil, etc. So we have harnessed, if you like, this. But in so doing, we have also, if you like, engaged in a Faustian bargain, by which I mean the price of cheap energy is now coming home to roost. And we're seeing this with rapid global climate destabilization. So we know for sure, Kira, that if we stay on our current pathway, we're heading into, even by mid-century, possibly sooner in some parts of the world, into a chaotic future. A future which most scientists say is incompatible with organized human civilization. Now, I know that's a lot for people to take on a Tuesday afternoon, but this is what we're looking at. This is what the science is telling us, that our access to an excessive use and wasteful, in many cases, incredibly wasteful use of this valuable energy. And I will say, Kira, this energy has also lifted people out of poverty. Mm. It powers, you know, maternity hospitals. So this isn't an anti-energy rant by any means. The trick is we have to find a way to power our civilization in a way that doesn't burn it down while doing it. At the moment, for example, we know that about 17% of our global energy is currently achieved using either renewables or nuclear. So it's a combination, in other words, ultra low carbon. That means 83%, more than 4/5 of our energy today, is by burning stuff. And as we burn stuff, we're burning down the atmosphere. So
I often find, John, that in any discussion that pertains to climate change, it's difficult for people in general, in parts of the world where that is yet to have a visible day-to-day effect, to really comprehend the scale of it or the magnitude that that effect could have on generations to come.
I think you're right. I mean, we're in what are called the mid-latitudes. So Ireland, for example, is relatively buffered. While we're seeing, Kira, extreme climate change, for example, in the high Arctic, we're seeing massive fires that are now burning from Siberia across to Alaska. And some of these fires, by the way, are burning 12 months of the year. Even during the snowy season, they continue to smolder under the snow, which is a pretty scary thought. Mm. Literally, when spring comes, they just flare up again. You don't even have to start them. So we're seeing continuous fire seasons. We've all watched with horror the Australian fires that killed 3 billion animals in 2020. 2018 and 2019, we had two once in 500 year heatwave events in Europe. And I remember this distinctly because I was driving around France with my family in July 2019 when we ran into one of these heatwaves, and we were happy, very happy to get out of it. And 2 weeks after we got home to Ireland, France was hit by another once in a 500 year heat wave. So there's no doubt about it that we know, you know, you don't have to go that far to experience this. And it is curious, we haven't had a major extreme weather event in Ireland for probably about 12 months. And typically what we get battered with in Ireland is flooding. Mm-hmm. We're extremely susceptible to flooding, and the Midlands in particular, highly susceptible to flooding. Now, the likelihood is we'll have another major flooding event before the end of 2021. If not, certainly within a year or two after that. It's just this is just how probability works. So I suppose what I set out to do in this particular article was to say, okay, right, we know all of these. We see the red flags flashing. What can we do about it? Is there a way out, in other words? Because, let's be honest, if we don't think there's a way of resolving this, well, then we just put our heads in the sand and we continue doing what we're doing and we just steam on and hope for the best. The problem, Kira, in climate planning, hoping for the best is not a plan, right? And at the moment, we have governments, including, I'd say, the Irish government, up until maybe very recently, whose plan was hope for the best and you never know, right? That's just not a plan when it comes to climate mitigation. So, anyway, the particular study that I looked at, what it wanted to figure out is it possible to reduce the amount of energy that's in use worldwide so that by mid-century we'll have about 9 to 10 billion humans, and is it possible to manage to give all of them the basis of what's called a decent life? Now, just to be clear about what a decent life means, that doesn't mean that you have the right to fly to the Maldives for a 2-week holiday followed by a trip to the west coast of America, then popping down to Spain. That is not your share of the global atmosphere. If that sounds like you, well, then you're grossly over-consuming your share of the global atmosphere. And you're not just taking it from your neighbour, you're also taking it from every human being that will ever be born in the future. We're rapidly running out of atmospheric space. This is a crisis that people really haven't quite got their heads around. And I think there's all kinds of reasons. If we had a lot longer, I could explain why, but we don't. So I'll try and stick to the particular study and what it looked at. And their basic thesis is that you take today's 17%. If we double that to twice what we have now of renewable energy by 2050, and then, so that brings up to about 34%, and then we lower the ceiling of energy use to meet it, they're basically saying we can provide a good life for 9 to 10 billion people using the same amount of energy that the world consumed in 1960. And how do we do that? By eliminating profligate waste. So, examples of profligate waste. International aviation, most of it is simply wasteful. We can survive comfortably without it, and it isn't just survive, we can live comfortably without it.
So would that be the end to foreign holidays?
Well, the hopping on a plane, buzzing over to, you know, somewhere for a nice cheap weekend, gone. Yeah, absolutely. Popping down to Spain for a few days because it costs €99, gone. Yeah. When you do that, remember, Kira, of the world's population, 90% have never set foot in an airplane and never will. So if you are one of the lucky people who's ever been on an airplane, you're already part of a global elite. So very few people in Ireland, we're great at saying how hard things are. But the reality of is, compared to most people in the world, we live very, very well. And there's 4 to 5 billion people in the world right now who are not having their basic needs met. Mm. And the real tragedy in the climate thing is that they're the very people. I'll give you an example. Farmers in Guatemala are being wiped out by climate change, and they're being forced with their families to flee the land that has burned out and to try and make refuge in North America. So this is something that the experts tell us as well, that we're going to see an awful lot more of what's called climate migration. Now, the UN have done some calculations on this. Their estimate is that by mid-century, by 2050, which is 30 years out, we could be looking at 1 billion climate refugees on the move. 1 billion. And by 2070, according to one estimate, there may be areas of the world that are today home to 3 billion people that will be uninhabitable for humans and for mammals.
I would imagine, John, there are two key pillars of making the proposals contained in the report on which you wrote about it in the Irish Times work. And one is reducing the overall energy consumption by each individual person on the planet. And then the other is how to provide the energy that these people do use, and therein is the crux of the problem, because we have manufactured, literally and figuratively, vast numbers of ways to use up energy which arguably we don't need. And then we only have a tiny proportion of the energy that we do consume produced by ultra-low carbon means. So it would look like, let's say, for example, here in Ireland, we should be focusing perhaps on solar and wind.
Absolutely. I mean, we're in a very fortunate position, by the way. We have the best constant wind speeds in Western Europe. I mean, you may have heard the expression, but Ireland could be and may well be the Saudi Arabia of wind energy, meaning that we should have the capability of being a major energy exporter for the first time in our history, where through interconnectors to Britain and Europe, where we would be selling huge amounts of wind energy. At the moment, we import about €6 billion worth of fossil fuels a year. And by the way, we're buying these fuels from some very, very regimes that people don't necessarily want to deal with. And our money is supporting regimes that most Irish people would find objectionable and would probably rather that we weren't supporting. So I think the notion of energy independence, the notion of us producing our own energy, and I will say as well, Kira, one of the factors that was mentioned in this article, they said that in rich countries, which of course includes Ireland, we need to reduce meat eating by about 85%. Right? We are over-consuming meat. And the reason that that's such a problem on a global scale is the number one driver of deforestation all over the world is clearing land, both for grazing animals, but also for the food that is then fed to those animals. So you might say, well, what's that got to do with Ireland? We're already deforested. We import millions of tons of animal feed from South America every year that is fed to our grass-fed animals, and we supplement them with feed. And that feed, forests are being cut down to produce feed for animals. At the moment, at any given time, there's about 50 billion farmed animals in the world. And 50 billion farmed animals plus 7 billion humans is more than the world can bear. Now, we the only way to deal with this effectively is to significantly reduce our dependence and our dietary levels. And they say, for example, in countries like Ireland, if we simply reduced our meat consumption to what health experts say are safe levels, we would already be well on the way towards reducing our overall emissions.
Well, John, unfortunately, time is against us, but thank you indeed for joining us and being so generous with your time. That is John Gibbons. He's an environmental journalist. He's also a co-author and has been writing on this topic in the Irish Times. Now, the Irish Hospital Consultants Association has highlighted just how behind the curve Ireland is in terms of its provision of mental health care and particularly acute mental health services. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Patricia Casey. She's a professor of psychiatry at the Department of Adult Psychiatry, UCD, and a consultant psychiatrist at the Mater University Hospital. Patricia, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you very much. Just to say, I'm now a consultant psychiatrist at the Hermitage Hospital.
At the Hermitage Hospital. My apologies. That data released by the Irish Hospital Consultants Association is stark. It shows a huge, huge drop since 2005 from 4,000 to 1,000 in the number of acute mental health beds available in Ireland, to say nothing of services in the community.
That's absolutely right. I mean, the drop in acute beds is very stark. And I think partly it's to do with government cost saving, but partly it's there's a bit of ideology going on there as well, that people should really be treated in the community, not be brought into hospitals. There is a stigma attached to going to a psychiatric hospital, even though they have all except two or three closed, and virtually all of our units now are in general hospitals. But nevertheless, the stigma continues, and this view that, you know, being treated in hospital isn't good for people. But of course, sometimes people need to be in hospital. And we now have one of the lowest number of beds per 100,000 of the population for psychiatry. At one point, we had more people in psychiatric hospitals than any other country in Europe. Now we're at the bottom of the pile. So it's as though the pendulum has swung extremely in the other direction, and now finding beds for patients is extremely difficult. And you know, when people are acutely mentally ill, they can harm themselves, they can die by suicide, they can occasionally harm others, but above all, people themselves and their families feel huge stress if they cannot get an acutely ill patient into hospital.
And I would imagine that those figures would paint a very different picture, Patricia, if the community mental health services available were up to the standard that mental health professionals themselves would want.
Well, not necessarily, because there comes a tipping point where all the community services in the world can't manage somebody in the community, because they simply need to be in hospital for their own safety, for their own protection, and for treatment. For example, take somebody who is very agitated. They've got a depressive illness. They're extremely agitated. They're pacing up and down. They don't want to take medication because they don't believe it's going to help them. In an instance like that, they may not necessarily be a danger to others or to themselves in terms of their life, but they are so distressed that they need to be in an environment where they will be able to, where their anxiety and their agitation can be managed. And most hospital admissions are short-term, you know, 10 or 12 days at most. So, but that message doesn't seem to have gotten out to government. And indeed, the public then, there's a sort of knock-on effect on the public perception about psychiatric inpatient units. And so there's no camera for more beds, but it is a very serious problem indeed.
Does this mean then, Patricia, that there are people throughout Ireland who should have been admitted short-term, 10 or 12 days, dependent upon their case, who have not received the kind of intensive mental health supports that their condition requires?
Absolutely. Yes, it does, very much so.
that must have a profound impact, not only on them, but on their families, their loved ones. So the ripple effect for mental health works outward from the person who needs the care.
Yes, it does. And that's a very good phrase that you've used. It does. It affects the family. It affects the person themselves because they're distraught, they're agitated, they feel guilty if they can't work. And of course, if they're so ill that they need admission to hospital, they would be unable to work at the time. So they're off work, on sick leave, they're not getting better. Their GPs will have tried to treat them. Sometimes even community services will have tried to treat them and do what's called home care, which is really just a community nurse looking in, visiting the person every day and making sure that they're okay. And then if they aren't trying to arrange admission, but there isn't a bed. So it has a huge effect on the patient, but on their family members who worry, will they harm themselves? Will they, you know, or if they're not eating, for example, if somebody is so depressed that they can't eat and they're losing weight rapidly, that becomes a worry. So there are worries for their physical health as well as for you know, their mental health when somebody is in that situation. And unfortunately, beds are closing all the time. It's even worse now at the moment, because each ward now has to designate one bed in every unit for COVID, so that if a new patient is admitted, they go into that room. It's an isolated room for 24 hours. They have their COVID test, and then if they're clear, they're allowed onto the main ward. But even if there is nobody who is in that bed, nobody who's a new admission, the bed still has to remain vacant for somebody who may be admitted. So it's putting a real pressure on beds. People, for example, who've been vaccinated and who don't need to use that bed, who could go straight into the ward, somebody like that would not get into hospital now. So there's a huge shortfall, and the government, unfortunately, doesn't seem to have any interest in making up for this shortfall. They published a new policy document last year called, I think it's called Seeing the Vision. It doesn't make any, sharing the vision, and it doesn't make any mention of increasing bed numbers or anything like that.
You'd wonder why, when the HSC seems to be engaged certainly in social media awareness campaigns about protecting one's mental health, that there aren't then the services to back up the needs of people whose mental health requires intensive care.
Well, you know, the HSC, with all due respect, are fairly remote from what's happening on the ground. For example, one of the plans in this new document is that child and adolescent psychiatrists should now be seeing young people up to the age of 25. At the moment, in many parts of they are supposed to be seeing them at the moment up to the age of 20. Sorry, up to the age of 18. But at the moment, they're not. They're only seeing them up to the age of 16 in many parts. So to now suddenly propose last year that child and adolescent psychiatrists should move from having a cut-off of 16 or 20 up to 25 is absolutely harebrained, because you know, they're not in a position to deliver that service. They don't have the resources. And in terms of consultant psychiatrists, they're the child psychiatrists are the by far and away the worst off in terms of having child psychiatrists available to meet the numbers, and they also have huge waiting lists. So these plans are very aspirational. They sound great on paper. They're full of words like respect, dignity, whole society approaches, whole of government approaches. But the reality is they're not actually listening to the people on the ground who are treating these people and who are coping as best they can with shortfall in services.
Well, Professor Patricia Casey, a Punchestown resident, I understand, Professor of Psychiatry at the Department of Adult Psychiatrist and Consultant Psychiatrist at the Hermitage. Thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we'll be talking ongoing restrictions in terms of partner access at maternity services. Protests have taken place outside four maternity hospitals today because of the ongoing restrictions on on the attendance of partners at some scans and throughout the early stages of labour. That is despite statements by the Health Minister, Stephen Donnelly, that restrictions at maternity hospitals should not be in place in the general course of events unless there is a specific issue in a specific hospital. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Creasia Lynch. She's chair of AIMS, the Association for Improvement at Maternity Services in Ireland. Creasia, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm just straight back from the protest at the Coombe.
And tell me about that. What was the feeling there among people protesting?
Well, first of all, just to reassure everybody, this wasn't an en masse mob protest. We ensured that we only had 9 people coming. But what we did actually end up having were people who had been in the car parks, primarily men, mm-hmm. partners who were in the car parks, who saw what was going on outside and who got out of their cars and came out to stand alongside us. So we had about 6 dads that joined the protests. And the mood was, one of expectation and one of anger as well, that there had been these restrictions in place, that they've been in place for so long, that there really has been, people say they've shifted, but they haven't shifted enough to change anybody's experience. And that's the best way of putting it. Yes, you might add an hour here, or you might take away an hour there, but that's not changing people's experience. And the biggest and the most difficult part of the whole maternity restriction issue is associated with induction and mm-hmm. early labour. And, the government's guidance says quite clearly that all people who are going through labour should have a partner accompanying them. Obviously, if they wish, not everybody wants a partner, but most people do. And it doesn't say they can only accompany them after the person's got to be 7 centimetres. It says accompanying them all the way through. And that's one of the things that we have not seen, and that's causing a huge amount of distress.
Why, Creasia, are individual hospitals then taking the decision to be so prescriptive when government guidelines does not back that up, neither do statements by the Health Minister and, I'm open to correction, by Chief Medical Officer Tony Houlihan in recent days?
You're absolutely correct on all of those scores, and the question is why indeed? And, we do have guidelines and we do have protocols in place that we're supposed to have unified responses to HSE decisions across all of our maternity units. And we have a national maternity strategy, which is like the rule book for maternity. So everybody who's involved in providing maternity care is supposed to adhere to that rule book. But what we've found now is that it would appear that everybody's doing their own thing, and that's not a safe situation for anybody. And one of the key issues I think that's been missing is that none of the units, and there's 19 throughout the country, that none of the units have provided a risk assessment that's publicly available, and none of them, it would appear, have provided a risk assessment to the HSE to account for their actions. So what we really need going forwards now is we need the HSE to insist upon those risk assessments. They need to be regularly audited, and if there's any issues in particular maternity units, the HSE needs to give adequate support so that those maternity units can be on target to lift the restrictions.
Do you have any sense, Creasia, either in terms of your personal perception or information that may have been conveyed to you, as to why the maternity hospitals have, on an individual basis, taken a decision which seems collective?
Well, it's unusual, isn't it? Because, in a sense, they're not collective. Because even if you look across the river between the north and the south of Dublin, the two big maternity hospitals there have had quite different approaches all the way through. Neither of them implement the guidelines, i.e. partners all the way through childbirth, but they have taken different approaches. And I think that what we're looking at here, I said before we didn't have the risk assessment. Mm. The other thing that we did have, which I think is where everybody stumbled, and that is that we started allocating partners the role of a visitor. So obviously the HSE and hospitals in a general sense have limited hospital visiting, and that's understandable. If you're visiting, Auntie Jo and she's had her appendix out, there's really no need for you to go in there.
No, Auntie Jo will be grand and she'll be home shortly.
Exactly. She'll be grand and she'll be home shortly. Exactly. And unfortunately, partners got, so they got that title of being a visitor. So then they started to be treated as if they had absolutely no part to play in pregnancy and birth, in labour, in supporting their partners. And that's, I think, why we saw those restrictions come into place in the first place. And very unfortunately, the hospitals have not yielded on that classification of a partner as a visitor. And that's, I think, if we were to do that, I think we'd see quite a different picture.
Also highlights the impact of linguistic appropriation. If you're labelling someone and categorising them as one thing and they are categorically not, we see what happens then in medical settings.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's one of the lexiconographic mistakes, if we want to be really technical. The other one is, of course, what is labour and what is childbirth? Because labour, when does that actually start? Well, if you asked all the women listening to you today who have had a baby, they're all going to put up their hands and say, well, labour started when I first felt that contraction.
Yeah.
And yet, in a hospital setting, people have all sorts of different views of labour. I mean, women often come into the maternity hospital and are told after 6 hours at home, oh, no, you're not in labour. And the woman's like, well, hold on, surely I am.
Yeah.
But often labour is divided into all these different categories for clinical use. And what we've seen here is we've seen that subdivision of labour into different components as something that's been used to exclude partners. And that's very unfortunate because labour is labour. It's a whole process. It might last 2 hours and it might last 48.
Well, Chrétia Lynch, Chair of AIMS, the Association for Improvements in Maternity Services in Ireland, thank you indeed for joining us.